It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today is Horticulture Day. A smooth, perfect green lawn may be very pleasing to the eye, but our love of lawns has created some problems, including excessive stormwater runoff. Fortunately, rain gardens can also be very pleasing to the eye, and they can make a big difference, helping to keep contaminants out of streams and rivers and reduce flooding events. Aaron Style of Ryman Gardens in Ames will be with us in a few minutes to answer questions today, but we're going to start with rain gardens. And Josh Bulk, Watershed Coordinator with the Iowa DNR, is here. Josh, welcome to the show.
Good morning, Charity. Appreciate the opportunity to be on the program today.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And let's start with the problem. When I talk about stormwater runoff, why do lawns add to that problem? We have runoff. We know we've got streets and sidewalks and all kinds of things that aren't absorbing. What's wrong with lawns?
So a lot of lawns in their landscape, although they might be green on top, what's going on underneath might not be as conducive as we'd like for absorbing that stormwater runoff. And so, you know, compacted clay soils, they can sometimes be as hard as concrete. And so they can contribute to stormwater runoff, picking up contaminants, pollutants, chemicals, you know, fertilizers that are on the yard, and then carry them away to our rivers, lakes, and streams where they can have impacts on the water quality there, as well as the aquatic creatures that live in there.
And how big a contributor are lawns to this problem? Because, of course, development is a big contributor to this problem.
Yes. I'd say that, you know, we all have our homes, we all have our yards, and we all have a role to play in our water quality of our state, which also opens up the door for opportunities, wonderful things like conservation, including rain gardens.
Let's talk about what a rain garden is. I think a lot of people don't really have an image for that. So do a basic description for me.
Yes. So the intention of a rain garden is these are designed landscape features, shallow depression in the ground, and we usually incorporate things like native prairie plants. So these can be attractive landscape features, but what we're really trying to do is intercept that water runoff coming from hard surfaces, whether that's a roof that's coming through a downspout, whether that's a sidewalk, a driveway, or just the yard itself. And so we try and intercept that water in that landscape depression and give that stormwater runoff a chance to be absorbed into the ground. And so underneath the rain garden, what's going on underneath the surface is we'll sometimes try and utilize the native soils there if they're of sufficient quality. Otherwise, we might need to do some additional excavation, maybe add some higher quality soils, a good mix of sand, compost, and topsoil, adding a thin layer of mulch, usually 2 or 3 inches, and then we have the beautiful flowering prairie plants on top. So it really does just look like a landscape accent feature to your yard, but we have those additional water quality benefits that can really help out our communities.
What are some of the signs that you might see in your yard or in the yard of a building that you spend time in that might make it a good candidate for a rain garden? Is there something that you're looking for?
So really anyone can be a good candidate. You know, rainwater falls on every place here in the state, and so those do open up the opportunities for rain gardens. You know, any chance we have to try and get water into the ground rather than using the stormwater infrastructure and pipes is great. But some considerations we have, you know, we don't necessarily put a rain garden in the lowest spot of the yard or the wettest spot of the yard. We maybe try and do it a little bit uphill, so that way it's not going to just be receiving water all the time without a chance to dry out, because that can be detrimental to plants. So we try and find a good location, maybe a little bit closer to the structure, so that way it can be a nice accent to the landscaping. And really, like I said, there's opportunities all throughout the yard. It's really just kind of identifying maybe a small area that the homeowner's willing to set aside for conservation.
Well, and you mentioned small, so let's talk about size. How do you know how large a rain garden should be?
Yep, and so there's some simple calculations you can do. The two main factors with sizing a rain garden is the drainage area to the rain garden. So, you know, the amount of roof or driveway that kind of drains to it. So you can just do some simple measurements to figure that out. And then the soils are also a factor. You know, we try and utilize the native soils, but like I said, if they're compacted, they might not be as conducive for rain gardens. So we want to at least have a half an inch an hour infiltration, and so there's some simple steps to test out your soil infiltration. But once you have those two numbers, there are some really simple calculations you can do to size your rain garden. We usually go with a pretty standard 6-inch ponding depth for the rain garden. So that's the amount, the difference between the top of the mulch and the surrounding land. So 6 inches is pretty standard there. And if you have good soils that are infiltrating over an inch per hour, you can go with 10% of your drainage area. So, you know, you think of you have a 500 square foot roof area with a downspout, you could potentially look at a 50 square foot rain garden. So these don't have to be very large. Otherwise, if you're limited on space, you can go with a deeper ponding depth, maybe going down 9 inches, and you can reduce the factor that you'd need for that rain garden sizing.
I can imagine that some people listening are thinking, this sounds a little bit intimidating. I don't want to have to do math and calculations and things like that before I plant something. But you can, once you pick the site, you can accomplish this in a fairly reasonable period of time, right?
Yes, that's very true. I've been very fortunate to work with many homeowners here in the Cedar Valley, and getting a handful of volunteers together, we've been able to knock out rain gardens in just a few hours. If you're willing to do the work yourself, you know, you can set aside a nice weekend and just spend some time outdoors enjoying putting some time in to end up with a landscape feature. Otherwise, there are professional landscapers and contractors here throughout the state that do offer the service of rain gardens. So, yep, if it does sound intimidating or you don't want to do the labor yourself, there are professionals out there that can assist.
Now, you've mentioned planting native plants in a rain garden. Is that an essential part of a rain garden? I'm all for planting native plants, but I think it's important to ask the question.
Yes, so we do encourage native prairie plants as much as possible. You know, their deep root structures really help in the rain gardens absorb the water and help it get into the ground. But there are non-natives that work well in there. You know, things like irises and lilies and hostas can also work in there. There are many, many plant species can work in there. So if there's something that folks are really passionate about, making sure that they can handle a little bit of water as well as those drier periods, they should be able to work just fine. And I guess another thing talking about plants, you know, we usually try and keep these lower growing native prairie plants. You know, if we can have them less than 3 feet tall, then they won't necessarily create a visual obstacle or anything like that. So nice low growing prairie plants are fantastic, but there are many others that work well in rain gardens.
Well, and I know so many people have been doing a lot of landscaping with native plants in just really the past decade or so, that has risen to a high art for a lot of people. So you're not necessarily just talking about a patch that looks like mixed prairie. People can do a lot of creative things within the realm of a rain garden, right?
Yes, that's very true. You know, each rain garden that's installed is customized for that home itself, you know, based on the size, the shape, the plants that are included in there. You know, if there's edging, a retaining wall, I mean, these can be really simple, small structures. They can be big, elaborate structures. It really depends, you know, on what the homeowner's interested in and what their desires are. So customizing it for each person is part of the game there.
Now, I've also spent a number of years involved in different prairie projects, and I know that it can take a long time if you're planting a reconstructed prairie for that to really take off. With a rain garden, how long do you feel like it takes before it's really established?
So going with larger size plants, you know, we usually recommend at least 3-inch prairie plugs to get things started. But if you get larger plants, you know, a gallon size plant and put that in there, you know, you can see flowering plants that following year. So yes, depending on the size, you know, it might take a little bit longer, but I'd say within a couple of years, you can have beautiful flowering plants showing off that wonderful landscape.
How much of a difference do you feel like it makes if one family creates a rain garden in their yard?
Yes, so one rain garden on its own isn't going to solve all the stormwater and water quality problems that communities might be facing. But we definitely see a growing effect when one homeowner does it. Their neighbors take notice, and so they maybe become aware of a rain garden and might consider installing one. And then you kind of just see that growing effect, and that's where we'll have a larger impact, because when more people are aware of rain gardens and more people get involved, consider installing one, that's where you can really have tremendous impacts.
So be that neighbor who gets out and tells people what you're doing in your yard, maybe even put up a sign, huh?
Exactly. Yep. There's signs out there to show off, you know, be proud of the conservation and the good work you're doing and encourage others to do it. That's exactly right.
All right. Well, Josh, stay with us because I'm sure people are going to have questions about rain gardens this hour. I'm talking with Josh Bulk, Watershed Coordinator with the Iowa Department of Natural Resources, and he is available to answer your questions at 866-780-9100. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Aaron Stile, Assistant Director of Ryman Gardens in Ames, will be here with us in just a moment to answer any question about plants and trees. 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and we've been talking about rain gardens so far. If that's a topic you'd like to discuss, you can give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio, or Talk of Iowa at Iowa Public Radio. org. And of course, you can also join us with any questions about plants and trees. Aaron Stile is here, Assistant Director of Ryman Gardens in Ames. Welcome to the show, Aaron.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here. And of course, Josh Bulk is still with us from the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. And let's go ahead and start off with a rain garden question. David is on the line in Des Moines. Hi, David.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, what's your question?
Well, we had a couple things. We have two rain gardens installed, one to take care of some flooding in our garage. The water would just build up and go into the garage, so we had basically a pit added back there. And then we had one done to take the downspouts on the front and side of our house. And the city of Des Moines actually will cover the cost up to $2,000 to have a rain garden installed through their stormwater best management practices.
Oh, that's fantastic. So that is great to know. I don't know if many other communities also have that benefit, but David, that's incredibly helpful.
Yeah, I think there are some, but in Polk County might, you know, for people that are just out in the county, but it's definitely something to look into. And then the question I had is the smaller garden / pit that's still in progress that was put in and back has some pretty steep walls on one side of it. And some of the dirt is just kind of collapsing. And I wanted to know what might be a good option for planting type of ground cover or something that would help just keep the wall from, you know, sliding in and the dirt from filling in the hole.
All right. Aaron, you want to take that?
Well, there are a few. The first thing that comes to mind are some of the sedges, because they tolerate kind of wetter conditions pretty well and are small kind of spreading plants. They're usually more clump forming than turf grass does, but they look more like turf grass. So that would be kind of the look that they would have in that situation. But really any smaller plant that you can plant in that area would root in and help. So it doesn't necessarily have to be a ground cover per se. You know, some things like hosta do quite well covering the soil, but don't spread like we think of a ground cover spreading. So those are some options.
Okay, that's helpful. Yeah, because right now it's just the grass and then bare dirt, and then we have irises in certain areas, and and it's not something that would be underwater, you know, really, because it does sit up quite a bit higher than where the water meet, you know, the maximum water line on it. All right, well, thank you.
Yeah, no, thanks a lot for your call, David. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Next up, we've got a Japanese maple question. Hi, Linda.
Hello, good morning. I have a Japanese maple that's been in my landscape for about 20-ish years. Beautiful tree. Over the last couple of years, I'm noticing that the heavier outer bark seems to be just coming off. I thought the squirrels were doing it, but no, it just seems to be the way the tree is growing. Is that kind of a bad sign for the health of the tree, or is it just the way the tree is aging?
Is there any kind of dampness or kind of oozing or anything like that that kind of accompanies where this bark is coming off?
No, it doesn't look like there's insect or animal damage.
Okay, so there are a couple of potential kind of disease issues that may cause something similar to this. And so that's why I asked that question. And so like looking at it a little bit more intently to kind of see if you notice any discoloration underneath that or anything like that would be helpful. But it is probably a combination of age and size of the tree and the fact that nearly all of Iowa is the very northernmost place that Japanese maples can perform well. In fact, many varieties don't do well at all in the state. And there are a few that do okay. And so winters can be really stressful on these plants. Going through 20 winters, 20 plus winters is going to cause some stress. So it may, it's most likely if it's not a disease issue, like a verticillium wilt kind of thing or a canker, then it is probably just a response to stress. This tree is, it's kind of likened to one of us trying to spend our times up around the North Pole or something, right? Like we could do it, but it would be a lot of work and really stressful. And we're at the very northern end of this range for this plant. And so it could just be kind of years and years of stress kind of adding up for this plant. So keeping an eye on it will be important, making sure that you don't have insect or other issues kind of moving in, and knowing that this tree isn't going to be a 50-year-old tree probably for you. And so kind of having a plan, maybe it is replacing with the same one. If you've had it for that long, it obviously does okay. But they're not, you know, oak trees in terms of living for many, many years. And so you may end up having to replace it here as well.
All right. Thank you for your help.
Yeah, thanks a lot for your call, Linda. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. And Josh, Marty in Pleasant Hill wants to know where he can see some rain gardens. Of course, seeing something like this is incredibly helpful. The internet is a great place to look, but do you have any other advice?
Well, I would say if you reach out to your local municipality, they might be aware of some local rain gardens. Otherwise, yep, doing a Google search can come up with something. But I would strongly encourage folks, if you're interested in learning more about rain gardens, iowastormwater.org. That's Iowa Stormwater Education Partnership. They have lots of resources, including photos, brochures, and information you can view and download to get everything you need from rain gardens to permeable pavement and anything urban conservation. So definitely encourage folks to check that out.
All right. Good advice. iowastormwater.org, you said?
That is correct.
All right. And we've got another rain garden question on the phone. Matthew in Iowa City. Hi, Matthew.
Yes, hi. It's I don't know if it's a question, because I can share some experience, I suppose.
Okay.
We do have it's not really a rain garden, but we have a 60 by 4 / 5 feet long strip of wildflowers in our urban lot in Iowa City. And I don't have any empirical evidence, but hopefully it does serve some purpose for water quality. But in addition to that, and going back to piggybacking on the mention of permeable pavers, we also did take advantage of a similar program, as a gentleman mentioned earlier, about best management practices for quality for water in Iowa City. And the city covered probably about almost half of our driveway. We put pavers instead of asphalt or concrete.
Oh, terrific!
And that was that. I think that has helped, and I mean, definitely helped with water in our basement. But also, I feel like the water disappears into those cells under the driveway instead of going down to the street or into our basement. Hopefully the resource, the .org site that was mentioned, has some of that for local, local areas. But I really encourage people to definitely look into all those, because, Iowa has such a crazy weather between frost and the freeze cycles, and the concrete doesn't seem to last as long as our bricks have held up. So long-term planning and water quality in all in one.
Definitely worth doing some searching and making a phone call. Josh, do you want to respond to that?
Yes, yep. I'd like to say that, yep, if you live within a city, definitely contact your local municipality. There can be financial as well as technical assistance that they offer homeowners, businesses, and anyone interested in conservation. And you can also contact your local soil and water conservation district. They might also have financial assistance available, but then can also get folks connected with the resources to provide the technical assistance, how to design a rain garden and that stuff. So I would definitely encourage folks to reach out to both of those organizations there.
All right. If you have questions, you can join us 866-780-9100. Tweet us at Iowa Public Radio or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Nick is on the line next in Iowa City. Hi, Nick.
Hello.
Hi. What's your question?
I have a question about what it takes to establish native turf and what the best way it is to go about it economically, how to do it without, breaking the bank.
Okay, so let's define some terms here. When you say native turf, what are you imagining?
As close as you could get to a normal lawn, something like bluegrass. I know the city of Ames has a whole brochure on best warm season turf grasses, and they list things like blue grama and buffalo grass. But when I do a search on that type of thing, they end up being really expensive to try and do for an entire lawn. So what are my options?
All right. Aaron, that sounds more like your area.
Yeah. Yeah. So it may be a little difficult to find kind of an economical seed source for these species of grasses. And buffalo grass and blue grama are good examples of potential native species that can be treated like our traditional lawn. So it'll take a little bit of investigating, and probably through a mail source or a catalog, basically. to find that. It's not going to be as cheap as Kentucky bluegrass or perennial ryegrass because there just isn't as much demand for it. So that part will be, you'll have to do some headhunting or some kind of scoping out and deal hunting when it comes for that. But the best time to do this work is in late summer, early fall. So the middle of August through mid-September. The other time that you can do it, you know, many of these are, they have a slightly different growing pattern than our traditional lawn grasses. So Kentucky bluegrass, perennial ryegrass are cool season grasses. Many of our native ones are warm season grasses. So they're greener in the middle of summer, and they're slower to brown up in the spring and brown up sooner in the fall, whereas cool season grasses are kind of the exact opposite. So some of the warm season grasses you can establish in the spring and with pretty good success. You have to basically remove the grass that's there, create a good seed bed, and then seed is going to be better than sod in terms of price. Putting it down and doing a good job of watering and getting it established that way, gradually reducing the watering just like you would with any other kind of new seeding for lawn. But it is true that finding a good seed source for this will be a little bit difficult. If you have a small area in your yard that's kind of separate from everything else, that might be a good spot to give this a try to see how it works for you. And so rather than doing your entire lawn, maybe there's a little side yard or a little patch somewhere that's kind of discreet from everything else that you can give it a shot at. I know, for example, at Ryman Gardens, we have a buffalo grass lawn, but it's distinct from other areas. And it was a great spot for us to kind of test out and develop and try new things when it comes to that, and then decide if it is, because this lawn behaves differently than our traditional lawn. So it might be good to kind of dip your toe in before doing your whole lawn in this.
Well, and Aaron, why do you think it hasn't caught on as much? It feels like we've had a lot of questions about this over the years, and maybe overrepresented in the public radio audience, the interest there. But it seems like a lot of people have decided that they would go with larger native plantings instead, or different landscaping ideas. Are there downsides to this that aren't easily visible?
The biggest difference is the way that they grow. So this lawn would likely be a warm season grass. It won't green up until the end of May, first part of June, which in a neighborhood really stands out when everybody else's lawn is very green starting in April and yours is still brown. Now, yours will be green through the summer, whereas other folks will start to get a little bit browner unless they're doing regular irrigation. And then it browns up sooner in the fall. And so that difference in the look of the lawn, I think, plays a role in this. The other big thing is that there is kind of a movement from a lot of people who have an interest in native plants away from lawns in general. And so the idea that most of us don't need, we're not playing bocce ball, we're not having soccer games in our front yard. And so the idea of having this big expanse of turf isn't really necessary for some folks, especially folks who are really interested in native plants. And diversifying it has more benefits to the local ecosystem, to inviting in more native insects and birds and other things. And so a lot of folks end up who have this real interest in native plants end up going that direction instead of trying to keep their lawn altogether.
Okay. So well, and it also, I suppose the larger plantings also signal to your neighbors, hey, we're doing something here, as opposed to my lawn is brown.
Yes. And you have a lot of explaining to do because people will think your lawn is dead, and it is not dead. It's just on a different schedule than everybody else's.
Okay. But if I want to play soccer in my front yard, do you think that buffalo grass is a good idea?
It is a little different than our classic Kentucky bluegrass and perennial ryegrass. It is, it's not going to be maybe as carpet feeling. It tends to be just a little bit more, I won't say scraggly because that's not nice to the turf, but it doesn't have that same refined look that we often look for in a lawn, you know, that golf course like look,
right,
that many people are interested in when they grow a really high quality lawn. So it does have a different look to it. And you have to be okay with that. It's still, the ball rolls on it, a soccer ball anyway.
All right.
Rolls
your
on
shoes,
it just
probably.
Fine.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, I think I could talk about this. We'll have to do a whole show about these lawn alternatives because
yes.
I think this is very interesting and I know a lot of people are interested in it. Let's slip in one more quick question here. This is from right along the Iowa-Minnesota border. Is it too late to trim or prune apple trees?
No, not at all. This is a great time to do that work. Really, the only plant this time of year that we're probably done pruning are oak trees out of a hope to not accidentally spread oak wilt.
All right. Your window of opportunity has closed for the oak, but you can keep pruning other things. We're going to take a
yes.
short break. We'll be back in just a moment. Aaron Style of Ryman Gardens in Ames is here, along with Josh Balk of the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. We've been talking about rain gardens and many other plants this hour. You can call with your questions. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. We started off the hour talking about rain gardens. Josh Balk is here, watershed coordinator with the Iowa DNR. He is here to answer your rain garden questions. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Aaron Style, assistant director of Ryman Gardens in Ames, is also here to answer all of your other plant and tree related questions. And let's get back to the phones. Ed is on the line next in Bettendorf. Hi, Ed.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Thanks for taking
yeah.
my call.
What's your question?
Well, the question is, I'm trying to understand how crabgrass keeps coming up in my yard. And I've already put down the pre-emergent for this year, and I've done that in the past, and I've put high concentrations on the areas where I know that the crabgrass is, but it still seems to come up, and I'm just trying to understand how that process works. Do I need to go through and actually cut out the old crabgrass for this to function properly and for me to rid myself of this evil?
This evil, all right.
So crabgrass is a weed that comes from seed every year, and that seed tends to germinate when soil temperatures are above 55 degrees. And for most of Iowa, that happens around mid-April through about mm-hmm. mid-May or the early part of May. And so what you're putting down in terms of crabgrass preventator is something that either that's something that prevents that seed from germinating or kills the newly germinating seed. And so I think if you've already put it down now, you're probably putting it down too early to have really good control. And so applying the herbicide a little bit later when soil temperatures are a little bit warmer may allow for better control. The other thing is if you've noticed that it's in kind of very specific areas, you can dig and pull it, especially before it goes to seed through the summer and into the fall, and then use the late summer, early fall to try to establish new desired turf like Kentucky bluegrass or perennial rye to help kind of outcompete the newly germinating seeds from the crabgrass in the spring. And late summer, early fall is a great time to establish new cool season lawns. So I think kind of doing those two approaches, there is a resource online from Iowa State University that will tell you soil temperatures by county because certain agronomic crops and fertilizers go down at certain soil temperatures. So they actually keep track of this. So if you're kind of wondering in general where about my soil temperature is in my area, you can consult that resource, which is nice as well.
Very good. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for your call, Ed. 866-780-9100. Ann is on the line next in Waverly. Hi, Ann.
Hello. Thank you for taking my question. I have a question about a lilac. I was given the lilac as a gift 5 years ago. It came in a bigger container, about 2 gallons, so it had a good size root ball. And in my ignorance, I planted it in a place where it only gets about 3 to 4 hours of sun. My question is, Is it better to leave it in that environment knowing that it just won't bloom great? Or should I take the chance of transplanting it because it does have sentimental value? So I'd rather it be sad than dead.
Mm. how big is the plant?
It is now probably about 4 feet.
Okay. If you think you can still manage to, you know, actually handle it, pull it up out of the ground and move it, now would be a good time to do that. Now through the first part of April, when it's still dormant, try to get the biggest root ball that you can and move it to its new place right away. So have the new place scoped out and move it to that spot all in the same day. Don't dig it out and then try to hold on to it and then plant it later. Try to get it all done in the same day. That make sure you water it in, even though it doesn't have leaves on it yet. And in general, lilac transplants very well. And you have lilac for flowers. And so making sure that it gets enough light so that you can appreciate those beautiful and wonderfully fragrant flowers, I think is worth the risk in this case to moving it.
How big should the root ball be? Because I have a tractor, so I can move it.
Oh, great.
You
are so
yes.
far
okay.
ahead of most people in this, Anne. This is terrific.
Yes. Your goal is to keep the root ball intact. You may wrap it in burlap or something like that to help it from falling apart while you're moving it around, or part of it in burlap. It should be a 4 foot wide shrub. My guess is that that root ball, if you can manage it, a 4 foot wide root ball would be amazing. Most people can't manage to get that out of the ground. But if you have the equipment to do that, the bigger the root ball, the less stress there will be when you move it, and the more likely it will establish nicely in its new spot.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for your call, Anne, and good luck with that. Boy, a tractor makes a world of difference, doesn't it?
yeah, that'll be a fun project.
Right? We've got a rain garden, a possible rain garden question here for you, Josh. This is from Tom in Davenport. He says, my neighbor's sump pump drains near our property line in our backyard, and in the late winter, early spring, this becomes a problem with water pooling up on our grass. Eventually, the water soaks in, but the ground remains extremely saturated for weeks. Are there any recommendations that you have to help reduce this issue?
So we don't, because there is such a wide variety in sump pump discharge, and they can be constantly putting out water, we don't necessarily want those incorporated into a rain garden, because if the plants and the soils are getting constantly soaked, they don't get a chance to dry out, and that can be detrimental to them. So an option instead of doing a rain garden might just be some native prairie landscaping. Utilizing some of those prairie plants can help encourage that water to get in, help absorb it, and save you from having to mow or landscape around that wet area. So like I said, I wouldn't encourage incorporating a sump pump to a rain garden, but there are indeed other alternatives for that.
All right. And Aaron, did you have anything you wanted to add to that?
If you can utilize shrubs in that area, there are a couple of really nice shrubs for the landscape that can tolerate some fairly wet situations, things like buttonbush. So I think elderberry usually does fairly well in a relatively wet situation. It is true, though, that letting it dry out between kind of when it gets wet is more beneficial. But if you can find some good kind of swamp-liking plants, then they're a good option.
Right, and then you don't have to run the mower through there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. Let's go back to the phones. Holly's on the line in Fairfield. Hi, Holly.
Hi. Hey, I have a question about my yews. I have several clumps of yews throughout about an acre of land. And unfortunately, with our snow cover this year, the deer discovered these ewes, whereas for 25 years, they've not really seen them. And so I'm trying to figure out, with a 25-year root ball, I'm thinking I have a chance of keeping them alive. And my plan is, after doing research, I'm not going to trim them this year. Things I read said, leave them, you know, to use whatever energy they have left in those poor spindly stems that are left. So hold off trimming, but keep them watered and fertilized this year. And then I could trim them next year because they're quite spindly. Does that sound like a sound plan? And any other suggestions?
All right,
I think
Aaron?
You can. Yeah, you can start with that. It will take many years for these plants to fully recover from extensive deer damage. You and other conifers do not recover at the same rate as deciduous kind of shrubs do. So, you know, if I had something come in and eat down one of my viburnums or something like that, within one growing season, it would definitely bounce back pretty nicely. A yew with extensive damage on it, it will not look like it did before for many years. And if it's bad enough, it may always have kind of bald spots in it. They don't have as many of those secondary buds to replace that growth as other kinds of plants do. So it may be more than a year before you are having plants that have recovered fast enough to be able to start trimming again kind of on a regular basis. So keep that in mind as you're be patient with the recovery on this and protect them from the deer next winter. Because once deer have a pattern or once they know where something's at, they are very habitual and they will come and visit year after year unless you do something to discourage it.
All right. Good luck with that, Holly. Thanks a lot for your call. And I have to share this great comment from a woman from Ackley. She says she and her husband decided to take the plunge with buffalo grass a few years ago. And she wanted to share that in the garden catalog, they didn't call the grass brown, but a beautiful buff color. She says in the spring, when they would come home to a brown lawn in the midst of all of their neighbors' green lawns, she'd say to her husband, "Aren't you glad we have this beautiful buff color?"
That sounds about right.
Right.
Yes.
Truth in advertising there. Here's a question from Brent. I failed to get my strawberry beds covered with straw this winter. Do you think I'll have a crop this spring, or should I plan on just replanting?
Oh, boy. We did have a really good consistent snow cover this winter over much of the state. That will work in your favor because that snow cover does serve as like a little blanket to help. The plants will likely survive just fine. It's the flower buds we're worried about. And so you can test it out, but I would be planning, you know, you can always start new day neutral plants to kind of last minute fill in if you're noticing that you're not getting the strawberry crop that you want. It's kind of a 50-50 situation, I would say.
All right. Here's a question, Josh, from Bill in Sac City. He says, prairie plants flower at different times of the growing season. So for the benefit of pollinators, which flowering plants would also work well for a rain garden?
So that's a perfect point. You know, when designing rain gardens, I usually try to get something flowering there throughout the entire growing season. So that way it's not only attractive visually, but then it's also helping out our pollinators. So, you know, thinking of some early bloomers like Golden Alexander, Columbine are good early ones. And then things like milkweed and coneflowers, they can keep it going throughout the summer. So, yeah, so having a variety of species in there will definitely help something to be flowering there throughout the entire season.
All right. And here's a question from Emily in State Center, Aaron. I have a large flower bed on the edge of our property, completely away from any buildings, with hostas in it, Carl Forrester grass, and daylilies. Could I burn this bed off without damaging the roots? This sounds like a stumper.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. I lost connection with you there.
Oh, okay. I was
quick.
Like,
so I heard she's interested in burning
pause.
It. She's
yeah,
interested
she
in burning it.
She wants to burn it, and she wonders if that'll damage the root system.
It won't probably damage the root system. If you have a good day and that fire kind of runs over the top of the bed, you won't see a lot of damage. The thing I would be worried about is some of those plants are pretty early to pop up most springs. And so anything, especially hosta and daylily, if they get damage like onto the tips of their leaves because you burned and they were up, that damage will be there all season. So that's something to consider as you're moving into this, actually all three of those tend to green up pretty early in the season. So you'll have to get out there and do it if you're going to do it before they pop out of the ground, or you're going to have little burnt edges on all the leaves, on all the plants for the rest of the season.
And it might be almost too late. It's pretty wet right now. You probably can't do it.
Yeah, especially that daylilies and Carl Forrester, both of those green up pretty fast.
All right. Let's get in at least one more call here. Robin's on the line in Iowa City. Hi, Robin.
Hey, good morning. So we moved into a house, and the woman who lived here before was amazing with plants, like awesome. I am not. I kill everything that comes within like 5 feet of me except for baby humans, which is fine because I want the humans to live.
Yeah, good.
Anyway, so we have a raspberry patch in the back that was amazing and had like the most gorgeous raspberries for 2 years. And since then, it'll flower out and then we get no fruit, even though there's tons of pollinators all over it. What in my ineptitude is making it so I don't actually get fruit?
When do the raspberries typically fruit? Is it early in the season or later, like later in the early summer, early late summer?
Late June, early July.
Okay. So there may be some, the plants may be a little crowded, and raspberries do appreciate kind of thinning it out. And so if you've noticed that nearly all the stems have flowers on them each year and they're just not setting fruit, and they set fruit a little bit later in the season, they're probably the type that are a little easier to manage. You can cut the whole patch down to the ground and get new growth to come up that will flower and fruit. If you notice that only about half of the canes have flowers on them at any given time and they flower earlier, then those are the type that flower on last year's growth. And if you manage them that way, you won't see any fruit. Are you doing any kind of cutback at all with the patch, or are you just kind of letting it go?
We do cut it back because if we let it grow, the canes will literally go to like 10 feet tall.
Mm-hmm.
So we do cut back. And the canes themselves really aren't that close together. They're probably easily like 18 inches apart from each other.
Okay. But you are seeing flowers.
We did last year, yes.
Okay. So that's good. Because if you weren't kind of managing it appropriately, you would run into a situation where it never flowers. And then, of course, you wouldn't have fruit. A lot of times, if we don't see good fruit set, it could be a couple of things. It could be that flowers are being aborted because of stressful conditions. So maybe they're not, maybe they're either too wet or too dry. A lot of times for raspberries, they're accidentally too dry, especially in midsummer for us here in Iowa. So kind of looking at that and watering when needed might be helpful there. It could also be that the raspberries aren't getting well pollinated. And so doing things to invite pollinators in may help some too. It would help either way, even if you had some of a raspberry crop, inviting more pollinators in would definitely help. So looking at those two things might be my next step here.
All right. Good luck with that, Robin. And I'm sorry we couldn't get to all of our questions today, but we will be back next Friday with Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. Aaron Stile, thank you so much.
Yes, thank you. You're welcome.
Aaron Stile of Ryman Gardens in Ames. And Josh Balk, what a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you.
Really appreciate it, Charity.
Josh Balk, Watershed Coordinator with the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. And again, if you'd like more information about rain gardens, check out iowastormwater.org. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe.